This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director, and I'm grateful for your company today. We seem to have a theme for today's show. I mean, other than bringing you all the stories from WMRA over the past week, that's always our theme. It's kind of like a zoo this week with lots of animal-related stories, including Harrison Berg's rejection of a bid by Anasira to take over the city's sheltering services, reported by Christopher Clymer Kurtz, and Jesse Nadler's stories about goat yoga and animal therapies for kids with autism. Also, from the Virginia Public Radio Network, we have a look at the myth of the American chestnut tree and what the Medicaid coverage gap means for some Virginians. But first, Senator Tim Kaine made his way around the state last week to kick off his bid for re-election this year. A week ago Saturday, he stopped at Pale Fire Brewing Company to meet with voters in Harrisonburg, and WMRA's Calvin Pinn was there.
Tim Kaine credited recent youth-led movements as the inspiration for his goals in his bid for re-election. He says the ultimate goal is to create a Virginia that works for all.
That's the question that's facing America right now. That's a question that's facing us in these elections.
Kaine was elected to the Senate in 2012 after a political career in which he served as Virginia's governor, lieutenant governor, and mayor of Richmond. He most recently ran as the Democratic vice presidential nominee alongside Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. His campaign philosophy is rooted in five pillars: jobs, education, healthcare, security, and equality. Kaine highlighted his goals, including increasing the minimum wage, expanding Medicaid, ending opioid addictions by the year 2030, implementing debt-free college and improving pay for teachers, and improving police and community relations, among others. Kaine praised Harrisonburg's openness to immigrants and refugees as an example for the rest of the country, and he criticized President Trump's harsh approach to immigration.
We need to challenge the administration on their philosophy, and then we need to work on ultimately comprehensive immigration reform. In the meanwhile, let's protect Dreamers, let's protect TPS recipients, but comprehensive immigration reform is what we need to do.
For WMRA News, I'm Calvin Penn.
On Tuesday, the Harrisonburg City Council voted unanimously to decline an animal sheltering services proposal from Anasira Veterinary Center, but the outcome left all concerned with hope for more cooperation in reducing the SPCA's euthanasia rates. WMRA's Christopher Clymer Kurtz reports.
The Harrisonburg City Council vote was a rejection of her proposal, but Kate LeMond, Anasira Veterinary Center's founding president and CEO, left the meeting claiming victory.
We are very pleased. The whole purpose of Anasira submitting a proposal was our concern about the death rate. What we heard tonight is that the City Council is also concerned and that they're interested in making changes to address that issue.
More about those changes in a bit. But first, it's been close to a year since Anasira submitted an unsolicited proposal to Harrisonburg City Council to take over the animal sheltering services for the city from the Rockingham-Harrisonburg SPCA. Anasira said it could provide the services for 25% less than the city currently pays the SPCA, plus operate using a no-kill model to significantly reduce the high euthanasia rate at the SPCA. In their recommendation to City Council this week, city management staff expressed skepticism that Anasira's facilities and foster network would have adequate capacity for possible influxes or legally mandated holding periods, and said Anasira's lower fee for the services could increase in future years. They talked of the city's previous investments in the SPCA and said that there is, quote, value and security in continuing to partner with Rockingham County, which also contracts with SPCA. And as for Anasira's promise of lower euthanasia rates, staff said that other localities have struggled to meet such no-kill goals. Staff did affirm what they said was progress in decreasing the number of euthanasias at the SPCA, which reported that its rate is down from 51% in 2016 to about 45% in 2017. But they also suggested that the council could consider amending the contract with the SPCA to include benchmarks and goals and periodic reports.
Although I believe this recommendation is in the best interest of the city, I just want to make it clear this is not an endorsement of business as usual.
Eric Campbell has been the city manager since the middle of January.
I am concerned with the euthanasia rates. I do believe this is a beginning of a discussion on how do we reduce those rates.
Councilmember Richard Baugh said that underlying the staff's recommendation to decline Anasira's proposal was a lack of direction from council to pursue a no-kill model. Plus, he said,
I think really part of the undercurrent here is city manager is telling us he'd like some time to work on this project.
The council discussed the frequency of required reports from the SPCA, and at Baugh's motion, unanimously approved the staff recommendation. After the meeting, City Manager Campbell said that his job is now to bring parties like the SPCA and Anasira together.
Each organization has some strong positives. The challenge is they're not talking to each other. We have all the good parts in the community. It's a matter of working to get them working in tandem, and I think we can get there.
That call for Anasira and the SPCA to work together surfaced repeatedly. Here's Councilmember Christopher Jones during Tuesday evening's council meeting.
How these two entities aren't working together for the greater good of the cats and dogs that are involved in this situation, it just baffles me. I understand that at some point you have different philosophies and ideologies, but at the end of the day, if you want more cats and animals to be adopted and live, you work with what you can work with one side and work with what you can on the other. It shouldn't be an either or.
Afterward, Councilmember George Hirschman repeated that call.
Some places there's got to be a little more cooperation between Anasira, and there's been very little over the years. We got to make that work a little better.
The SPCA's Jo Benjamin said she welcomes ongoing discussion with the city about the shelter's successes and challenges, and she's open to community help.
It's a community issue, and it requires community solutions. So if Anasira and other local rescue organizations would like to work together, we are happy to take their application. I really think there's a lot of potential for us to work together and collaborate.
Can that happen? Again, Anasira's Kate LeMond.
If the SPCA is able to embrace some of the philosophies, some of the policies and procedures that are consistent with the no-kill or life-saving model, absolutely. Time will tell.
With the dismissal of Anasira's proposal, Mayor Dena Reed pledged to pursue lower euthanasia rates through holding the SPCA accountable.
I'm going to be very diligent in making sure that the SPCA progresses the way we need them to progress. And with those 6 months reports, I'm going to make sure we hold them to that. So I think there's hope for both sides. I'm hoping that maybe they can work together.
That change, she said, would be a winning outcome. For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Goat yoga. Doing yoga with goats is having a moment right now. The West Coast fad has come to our part of Virginia with Rockbridge County, the latest locale to offer stretch sessions with barnyard friends. WMRA's Jesse Naylor drops in on one of these classes to find out what the bleat is going on.
On a recent Sunday afternoon in Rockbridge, 15 yogis stretched and posed in a toasty studio while four adorable miniature goats munched hay and cuddled underfoot. It might seem like an odd pairing, yoga plus goats, that to some might scream gimmick, but it's also just fun, says yoga teacher Susan Dixon.
It's definitely less serious than yoga in a normal yoga studio. Yoga is the secondary reason for coming, obviously.
Research does show that time spent with animals can increase people's level of the feel-good hormone oxytocin. Here's student Lorden Hoff.
One of them kissed me on the mouth while I was lying down on the mat.
Working out with goats is a reminder to not take yoga, or life, so seriously. Like when a goat has an accident in class, you just kind of go with it. The owners are on hand to quickly clean it up. Classes run Sunday afternoons at The Barn at Autumn Ridge. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
And you don't want to miss the cute goat pictures that we have posted with that story at our website. As part of our recognition of National Autism Awareness Month, all during April, WMRA is examining the spectrum disorder and the people affected by it. This week, we explore how animal therapy, specifically using horses and dogs, can help kids with autism. Jesse Nadler has that story.
Brady is 13 years old and has autism. Unlike some kids on the spectrum, Brady is a thrill seeker. He loves the water, loves roller coasters. Perusing the aisles at a loud and crowded box store, not a problem. It's also extremely difficult for Brady to communicate. He tends to echo speech repeatedly.
Well, it's also good.
But this hasn't stopped Brady from riding horses since before kindergarten. He's involved in the therapeutic riding program at Ride with Pride, a horse facility in Augusta County. Tonight, he mounts a Welsh Clydesdale cross named Maggie from an elevated ramp. He's supported by his instructor, Alex Walden. Four handlers surround Maggie from the ground.
Okay, Brady, can I have a really loud walk on? Walk on? Walk on? Nice!
It is a huge deal for Brady to be able to receive and give direction, particularly from on top of a horse. And that, in a nutshell, is why his mom, Elisa, enrolled him in Ride with Pride. It has given Brady a voice. When he first started the program, he would barely look at the horses. Now he literally takes the reins. Instructor Alex Walden.
He did his first horse show, which is a big deal. He actually went through like the different tasks and he won ribbons, and his mom was so proud of him, and I was so proud of him.
Horsemanship for people with autism can defy expectations. Program director Kelsey Lasher.
I think that people tend to label that somebody has autism, but the reality is that they're an individual person, and they all communicate differently. They all interpret things differently. So we've got to teach them and work with them differently, just like we would other human beings as well. So they're not labeled by their disability.
And Maggie, she's pretty much zen. Careful, calm, but she's still a horse. In the middle of Brady's ride, she paused to shake her head.
Wow! It's okay. Oh! Well,
did you like it?
Faster.
Sorry, guys.
His mom says it was one of the first times she's ever heard Brady use the word faster. Dogs are also another widely used form of therapy for people on the spectrum. Take Sam in Charlottesville. Sam is 11 years old. He loves math, trucks, and tractors. He's also prone to anxiety. And unlike Brady, he prefers to stay home where things are safe and predictable. About a year ago, his family got a service dog, a big, calm black lab named Forrest.
Oh, is his tail wagging you?
That's Sam's mom, Jessica Neal.
Whose dog is that?
Sam's.
Does he make you calm?
Yes.
When does he make you calm?
Crying.
When you're crying?
Forrest has a way of dialing in on Sam's anxiety. He was dialed into Sam even before he really met him. Jessica recounts the very first night they brought Forrest home. Forrest hadn't really been introduced to the three brothers. Sam is the only one with autism, yet Forrest was able to sense which bedroom Sam slept in. Sam likes to sleep with his bedroom door closed.
Forrest walked down the hallway to sit outside of Sam's room and started whining a little bit. And I was kind of like, okay. So I just opened Sam's door and he kind of poked his head in there and just looked and just, he just wanted the door to be open. He didn't do that with any of the other kids. He just somehow knew that was his person right away, immediately, the very first day that they met.
Jessica attributes this intuitiveness not only to careful training, but breeding. It costs approximately $40,000 over 2 years to raise, train, and place a successful service dog, according to Service Dogs of Virginia, where Forrest came from. They receive enough funding that they're able to provide service dogs at no cost to those in need.
I feel like we won the lottery.
Jessica says Forrest now knows Sam so well, he's able to sense when Sam's about to get upset, sometimes even before she does. Forrest will toddle over to Sam's side for a deep pet or even lay down so Sam can use his body like a giant pillow.
And you can just see, it's amazing, Sam's whole body will just kind of melt.
It's still unclear exactly why animal therapy seems to work for autism. Little scientific research has been conducted, according to the Autism Society of America. They say its effectiveness has to be evaluated individually. If it seems to work, go with it. And for Jessica, the Forrest effect has changed her entire family.
I am more calm as his mom. His brothers are more calm. We're all more relaxed.
It's meant that Sam is now able to join his brothers in activities that would have been unthinkable a few years ago. He even went trick-or-treating last October with his furry buddy tethered to his side. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
State lawmakers began meeting in Richmond last week for a special session. They did not finish their work during the regular legislative session because they could not agree on Medicaid expansion and the coverage gap, and that's important for the budget. Those phrases, the coverage gap and Medicaid expansion, are used a lot in the news. Virginia Public Radio's Mallory Nopain breaks down what they mean.
When the Affordable Care Act became law 8 years ago, the premise was health care for everyone. Americans were divided into three categories: high income, middle income, and low income. High income, simple, health insurance through an employer or buy it yourself on the newly created marketplaces. Middle and low income, slightly more complicated. To help explain, here's Victoria Napke. She's a Virginian. She doesn't have health insurance, but she wants to.
How does it impact your life?
I would say pretty greatly. I used to be on medications. I used to take SSRIs daily, and I haven't had those in 6 years.
What are SSRIs? What are they for?
Like mood stabilizers, like for mood disorders, things like that, anxiety. I haven't been able to get those filled in years.
2 years ago, Napke was working full-time at a cafe, part-time in retail.
And with those two incomes combined, I was making a total of about $11,000, just under that. And neither of the two workplaces offered insurance through the workplace.
Napke fell into the low-income category. Under the original vision of the ACA, low-income Americans were to get free health care through an already existing program called Medicaid. Until then, Medicaid had been primarily for kids or people who were disabled. But the federal government said to states, let's expand it to include poor adults. Virginia, along with 16 other states, opted not to. State lawmakers said it would cost too much, which meant, for Napke, no free health care.
The one that actually covered enough to allow me to go to the doctor more than once a year would have been about $500 a month. And when you're making $800 a month, that's all of the money that I was making.
Don't forget, there's still one category left, middle income. At $11,000, Napke was just shy. If she had made a bit more, she probably could have afforded insurance on the marketplace. That's because middle-income Americans get subsidies in the form of tax credits. That $500 a month plan might have cost Napke less than $100 a month. But because she was low-income, the government assumed she'd have Medicaid. So no subsidies.
Yeah, there's no tax credit for you in the marketplace.
Jill Hankin is with the Virginia Poverty Law Center.
Someone with that very low income cannot afford to pay for the insurance that's offered there. So that's why Virginia still has hundreds of thousands of uninsured people.
400,000, to be exact. That no man's land was created when Virginia opted not to expand Medicaid. It's called the coverage gap.
So if I'm a poor adult without children, that makes below $12,000 a year, is there a comprehensive, affordable health care option for me in Virginia?
No.
And that's been the state of health care in Virginia since the Affordable Care Act passed. The plan for high-income and middle-income Americans played out, but the vision for low-income Americans never did in Virginia. That could change in the next couple of weeks as lawmakers continue to battle out Medicaid expansion. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
Finally today, the American chestnut tree has mythic stature in tree lore. Today, the old giants are long gone from the landscape, wiped out by an Asian blight 100 years ago. And even though they still loom large in the history and culture of Appalachia, new research suggests their mythic proportions are likely just that, more myth than reality. More from Virginia Public Radio's Robbie Harris.
This is a story about a species of tree that seemed to grow taller in the decades after it nearly went extinct. The American chestnut is remembered, actually revered, as a towering giant, central to the economy for its nuts and resistance to rot. But did it really grow as tall as people think? Well over 100 feet tall. The question occurred to Roanoke College biologist Rachel Collins while she was researching American chestnut on the internet.
And I came across this statement that there was a 17-foot diameter American chestnut in Francis Cove, North Carolina. And so if you were to lay out a tape in your living room of how big is 17 feet, it would really be a monstrous tree in the East.
So Collins contacted Virginia Tech forestry professor Carolyn Copenhaver, who wondered,
are we remembering American chestnut as a larger tree than it actually was?
Since there's no way to measure missing trees, they scoured written accounts made hundreds of years ago.
Because we had been working with a lot of these historical documents, a lot of the folks in the 1800s were recording tree sizes as circumference rather than diameter. So we kind of had to go back to our high school geometry class and think about how do you calculate circumference from diameter. And circumference equals pi d, where circumference equals 3.14 times the diameter of the tree.
Copenhaver says by the 20th century, new tools made it easy to convert circumference into diameter. But once the mention of that alleged 17-foot diameter got into the record, it got cited and repeated again and again. Rachel Collins.
And so it gives you the impression that American chestnut were 120 feet tall. And so that would be like 40 feet taller than our forests are today.
Copenhaver says the American chestnut is what's known as a charismatic species, and that may have helped elevate it in people's minds as well.
And I think the loss of this species really brought a lot of emotions for people. They actually were able to see this on the landscape. There would have been areas where you would have had a lot of standing dead trees, and the blight itself moved pretty quickly. Some of the estimates they have is that it was spreading 19 miles per year. And so if you were in an area, you would see an entire removal of chestnut within your lifetime. And I don't think we have a whole lot of other things that are like that, where you can really see the impact in the forest.
It may be why, for the last several years, people have been pitching in with the American Chestnut Foundation to help resurrect the beloved tree. Armies of volunteers are part of projects to backcross remaining specimen with their blight-resistant Chinese cousins for a hybrid that looks and pretty much is exactly like the natives. Some tree experts still hold to the idea that the trees were towering, and they agree to disagree with the research in Collins and Copenhaver's paper. Since none of the new crop has yet reached maturity, it's impossible to know for sure how big and tall they'll grow.
But where that problem falls is if we have this expectation that this restoration work is going to lead to American chestnut being this huge tree on our landscape, then people are going to think that the restoration work didn't work, that it was a failure. And so I just think it's important for us to have a realistic understanding of what the American chestnut tree used to be in the Appalachians. And that is something worth saving.
Collins, Copenhaver, and their co-authors published their paper re-examining American chestnut trees in the Journal of Forestry. I'm Robbie Harris.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. You, too, can support local news coverage. Just go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. In the meantime, to get a daily local news update on your smartphone, every weekday morning, subscribe to our news podcast, the WMRA Daily. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I will talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.